Everyone's dancing in swimsuits. What's not to love? All right, we are joined today by a special guest, Amy Merrigan. A good friend of me and Maya's. She hails from the United Kingdom. She spent some time in Davis, California, where we met. And we met through the power of musical theater. And she's going to talk to us today about something very near and dear to her heart. So welcome, Amy Merrigan.
Hello.
Amy, we're so happy to see you. Well, not see you, see your audio waves, but hear you.
I'm so happy to be here.
You know, Amy, we see all these analytics of vaguely where people are in the world that download our show. And we see all these UK listens, and we've always imagined that that's just got to be you.
Yeah, that's me. That is pretty much me, probably sometimes Inez. But yeah, that's just me, like, listening to old episodes every single day.
That just made my month. So we've talked off and on for a couple months now about you coming on to the podcast, and we've gone through some ideas. Can we reveal to the listeners what we kind of fell on?
Yeah, so partly because it's just come out recently, the sequel has, and partly because I love it with all my heart. I wanted to talk to you guys today about Mamma Mia, the movie.
Here we go again.
Punny.
Which...
Yes.
Yeah, Mamma Mia 1 and 2, which you guys... Were you saying earlier that you've both seen the first one, but not the second one?
I watched the original last night while drinking wine with my mom.
That is just the perfect way to watch it, I would say.
I had to, you know, for research of my critically acclaimed podcast, you know, but it wasn't fun for me, you know.
And are you fans?
You got to be careful with what you admit on the internet.
This is true. So I think there's a fine line. I do like Mamma Mia. I think these songs are classic and not in a way that a lot of musical numbers have been able to just be mainstream, you know, and be played on the radio or every single bar you go to. In that said, I think it's not necessarily like my musical or my movie, but I have a fond appreciation for Mamma Mia. And like, is it your favorite? Because I'm picking up that it might be one of your favorites.
Well, I just love it. And I'm here to convince you that you love it as well.
Okay, challenge accepted.
I'm ready.
Okay, so some film critic said about Mamma Mia 2 that the second one is like mass-produced Prosecco and the first one is like vintage champagne, which I really agree with. Mm. And, you know, still love Prosecco. Second one's great. But the first one really is like, it's something pretty special. And I think the main reason is that it's pretty rare, even more so 10 years ago, to have a big blockbuster movie that is female-led completely, as well as the like leads all being women, is like written, directed, and produced by three women who all also produced the stage show.
Oh, wow. I did not know that.
Yeah. So in Mamma Mia 1, you've got this like plot set up at the beginning where Sophie wants to find out who her dad is so he can walk her down the aisle. And it's like this very classic sort of movie question that's posed, like, who will my dad be so he can walk me down the aisle? But then as the film goes on, the three male characters, they don't actually really get very much screen time, particularly. Like, they're kind of sidelines. Like, they're really funny and they're great, but there's someone worked out that 3 minutes of the film is spent exclusively dealing with the men, whereas 30 minutes is devoted to like Donna and her two best friends. And then, like, obviously the main bulk of the film is actually about Sophie and Donna. And as we go through the film, like, you think it's going to be about finding her dad, but there's this shift at some point in the middle where she goes, actually, I don't really care about finding... Well, at the end, she says, like, I don't need to know who my father is. And she asks her mother to walk her down the aisle instead.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole kind of arc and plot of the film is about the relationship between the mother and the daughter. And it's not really about the relationship between like the father and the daughter, or even Sophie and Skye, who the one played by Dominic Cooper, who doesn't really like, he is so secondary to the plot. Let's be honest. They don't even get married in the end. like at the beginning, like at the end,
mm-hmm.
Sophie rejects both husband and father, and she goes with her mother, and a sort of, she kind of decides that she wants to be with Skye as an equal rather than as a wife.
Yeah, the way they do it is so weird. Like, it's at their wedding, and it's all dramatically revealed that Donna doesn't know who the father is. And then they all just sort of agree to share her. Like, I think Colin Firth has some speech where he says, if I just had one third of you, it would be okay. And it's all kind of weird.
But it's like, it's sort of like subverting the whole thing, because the film like poses this question and then never resolves it, because actually it's not important, because you like shift from the paternal to the maternal.
Okay, fair which enough.
Which is why I think it's a deeply feminist film.
I definitely think that it passes the Bechdel test with flying colors.
Yeah.
What is that?
Oh, have you not heard of that?
Could you explain?
Okay, so the Bechdel test is basically... is there a certain amount of dialogue between women that is not about men?
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. I think it's, what, do you know the exact numbers, Amy, by any chance? Is it like 4 minutes?
Oh, yeah. Well, the original thing was, to pass this test, the film has to have more than one woman characters who talk to each other about something that isn't a man. And then, so loads of films don't pass that. And mm-hmm. then, like, someone kind of realized that, like, people would put scenes in films of, like, two women just at the end of their conversation about a man, they would like talk about who's going to pay the bill for dinner. So it would pass. So then somebody said that, oh, it should be for a certain amount of minutes, but I can't remember how many minutes that is.
Yeah, it was basically, you know, I think it's a great test to have. And clearly, like, Mamma Mia meets all of these. But I want to hear like a little bit more about, like, besides, you know, not just talking about men and like shifting to the mother-daughter relationship other than the romantic relationship or father-daughter relationship between men and women. Why else would you say this is like a feminist handbook type thing? Like what else should we expect?
Well, it's also like so rare to have a film that's led by like older women. Like it's kind of very, like the focus of the film is Donna, really, Meryl Streep. And the other, I'd say, two biggest characters are her two friends. So you've got three, like, older women leading a blockbuster movie. That's pretty rare. I remember reading that, like, in that, last year or something, out of all the top 50 blockbuster films, three films were female-led, three of those films out of 50, and one of them was Finding Dory, which isn't about a woman, it's about a fish. So, yeah, just the fact that it's, like, led by these three women, about the mother, da-da-da, I think that says a lot. And then also there's a lot of stuff you can read about how the whole thing is kind of relates to, like, feminist versus post-feminist theory. And, like, there's this whole theory that, you know, the film, as well as being nostalgic about ABBA, is also nostalgic about, like, feminism in the 70s. And so you've got the three older women who are like old school feminists, and then you've got Sophie, who's like sort of a post-feminist, because she's quite, you know, traditional conservative, wants to get married at 19, and the three older women are like almost slightly disappointed by that. Like one of them says like, oh, if she was anything like me, she wouldn't be getting married at all. So there's this whole thing about like how the three of them represent different kinds of feminism and stuff like that. But that's possibly getting into it slightly too deep.
Wait, I'm actually curious. If you don't mind, could you?
Yeah, I was reading this the other day. So like Tanya, so there's like liberal feminism, cultural feminism and maternal feminism. So Tanya is liberal feminism because she's like liberal feminism is like acting within the system. So she's like...
Oh, the plastic surgery lady?
Yeah. So she's like acted within the system of marriage to sort of get what she wants, become wealthy and kind of powerful. And she's used her like, I don't know, attractiveness and stuff to get that.
Yeah.
And then Rosie, who's the one with the bookshop, is cultural feminism because it's kind of about like intellect and like, I think the phrase is like raising your consciousness and things like that.
Okay.
And then Donna is maternal feminism because she's like been the single mother and blah, 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 blah.
You know, on the surface, it seems too far, but, you know, hey, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it is, but also that's what like film academics do, I guess.
And that's what's fun, you know, you can look into it as much as you want.
Yeah.
I didn't realize people had gotten so into this.
Yeah, like there's a whole book on this that I read a while ago. It's great. I will remember what the title is and send it to you. But I think the other really interesting thing about it is that, so if you think about ABBA, which, and I love ABBA and I love the songs, but there's this weird like imbalance where it was the men who wrote all the songs and the women who sang most of the songs.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's made even more weirder by the fact that they're married to each other. So you've got like the guys writing songs about like in first person sung by a woman. So like the guys are like writing the female experience, like for writing for women. And they're writing like in some of the songs, like Knowing Me, Knowing You is about the breakup of their marriage. And Bjorn, I think who wrote it, the one who wrote it, is like writing this song for his ex-wife about their breakup, which is odd, I think.
That is weird.
So, and then also you've got like some songs like Does Your Mother Know? In the ABBA song is sung by is one of the few ones that's sung by the guy, and it's a bit creepy. Like it's kind of like, it's sort of like about this, about a kind of maybe 16-year-old girl trying to flirt with like an older guy and him saying like, oh nah, can't do that. But it's like a bit weird. Whereas in the film it's sung by Tanya, so it suddenly becomes quite funny and like flirty and sort of fun again, because it's sung by this older woman and it's sort of chiding like adolescent male sort of over enthusiasm, and it's suddenly not that creepy. It's like it's funny again. Similarly with like Lay All Your Love on Me, which is the one that Sophie sing, no, it's the one that like Sophie and Sky sing on the beach, but it's mainly sung by, in the ABBA version is sung by a woman, but the movie version is sung by the man. And it's like, it just makes, I just think it makes it so much less creepy, because the ABBA version,
don't go,
that one, yeah,
your devotion,
yeah. And the whole thing is like, oh, I wasn't jealous before we met and now I'm obsessed with you and like you're all I need and da, 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 da. And it's like such a cliche when it's sung by a woman, but when it's sung by a man it suddenly kind of takes on a new life. And it's the same with Thank You for the Music as well, actually, because this is another one that is written by the husband for the woman to sing, for the wife to sing. And it's kind of saying, thank you for the music that you've written that has made me successful. It's like a bit weird. Whereas in the film, it's kind of sung by Sophie about, like, she's saying thank you to Donna. So it's like, it kind of just suddenly isn't creepy anymore. And the fact that the film regenders like a lot of these songs, I really enjoy.
So do you think the regendering is uptaken by different audience members differently? Like, if a male is watching it, do you think he's still gonna get the impact that the writer is intended for?
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where you don't necessarily notice it happening. Like, you don't really think about it when you first watch it. But
I definitely didn't.
Yeah, particularly with songs like Does Your Mother Know? Like, that song is just a bit creepy in a Me Too era, I think.
Mm.
So when you hear it in the film, you can enjoy it again.
There's a lot of Broadway songs that I think are problematic once you re-listen to them.
Yeah.
You know, post-Me Too era. I was listening to 16 Going on 17 the other day, and I hate those lyrics.
Yeah. I went to see 42nd Street the other week. And it's like, it's so classically Hollywood that it's so kind of inappropriate as well.
Mm-hmm. I feel that. I think, so going back to the whole music thing, I think, you know, that's one of the integral parts of musical theater is how the music serves to enhance the story. And I think that if the music had been used in the way that it was originally created, it wouldn't have enhanced the story in the way in which the writers wrote it. So I think,
yeah,
I don't know, these points they really are brilliant, and I think there's so much more that went into this film and musical that a lot of people didn't pick up on. I mean, you're shedding light on things that I was like, oh, I mean, yeah, sure, Mamma Mia, you're like, feminism, woo, there's like two women and mother-daughter, that's very important.
Mm.
But I don't know, this brings a whole new light to it. What other maybe talk about the second one. How does that hold up?
The second one, I think, like, the difference between the two of them is the first one, because it was based on a musical that's like has a book that's written by a writer, like it has I think the reason it has all of these sort of kind of, I don't know, deeper meanings is because it's a really well-crafted thing. Even though the plot is kind of on first viewing frivolous, the reason it's so enjoyable is because it's so tightly knit and, like, you know, the setup is very easy to grasp and all of these things. So I think although the second one is really enjoyable, it doesn't have that kind of narrative drive in it, which doesn't give it the depth that, like, the first one has and the stage show had, I think. But I really enjoyed the second one. Like, the whole thing is worthwhile for Cher singing Fernando.
Oh,
that is it's an out of body experience. I heard
what a queen.
I heard on another podcast. There was a newsreader, one of, like, Samira Ahmed, who's a newsreader in the UK, said there was a moment in that film where Andy Garcia strokes Cher's arm, and it's the most erotic thing I've ever seen on screen.
The classic arm stroke,
which I wholeheartedly agree with. She is just insane. And, like, her voice is incredible. It's just amazing.
I'm really glad that you are supporting her, because I've read a lot of reviews from people not our generation who have been really disappointed with the casting of Cher in this film instead of someone else.
Because she's so near in age to Meryl Streep.
Mm-hmm. Because she's literally 3 years older and she's playing her mother.
Yeah. Which is fair. That is true. And it just doesn't really make sense.
I don't know. How did you feel as an audience viewer?
I think, like, if it's, like, Mom, as a universe, Mamma Mia doesn't make any sense. Like, the world is so camp and, like, otherworldly. And, like, at the end of the film, they all put on 70s suits and sing, you know, Super Trooper or Waterloo. So I can kind of buy it, you know. But I can understand that that's ridiculous, particularly as, like, so many women often get cast as mothers to really when they're prematurely, I suppose.
Maya.
Mm-hmm.
Maya always gets cast as the mom.
Really?
Mm-hmm. It's very true.
That's really sad.
Yeah, it's a little much.
Oh, mate. So I get that as a criticism, but I think also, like, the fact that ABBA is so like such an institution, and Cher is also so iconic. It's just such a good fit.
Do you think, though, that choosing Cher was a cop-out because they couldn't get Meryl Streep? Because that's what I've heard a lot.
Oh, really? But Maya, she's in the scene at the end that honestly made me just sob. Like, when you see it, it is emotionally draining. But going back to your question, yeah, I heard as well that apparently Meryl Streep was just like, I don't do sequels. I'm Meryl Streep. I don't need to do that. And they were kind of like, fair enough. So yeah, I kind of have mixed feelings about it, because it also, the whole thing doesn't really make sense with Donna dying, like, so soon after the end of the first film. It's just quite sad, really. They never really address it. So,
oh,
is that how they do yeah. it? So she dies?
Yeah. So basically, spoiler alert, but the film starts, the film is 5 years after the end of the first one, and it's never, like, addressed how she died, but Sophie is now running the hotel and Sam is still there, and, like, they're both very sad, and she died a year ago, so that she only lived for 4 years after the first film. So if she was ill, she only had, like, 3 years of happiness, which is really sad.
Very sad.
That's so real life, though, I guess.
Yeah, I suppose so. But that's I think that's what's weird about it, because Mamma Mia isn't real life.
Yeah.
So it's sort of like bringing this, like, really, like, gritty drama into the campest musical in the world.
Yeah.
So it's almost like in my head, I've just kind of decided that, like, Mamma Mia 2, I've enjoyed it, but it's not, like, real, you know? Like, it didn't really happen.
Interesting.
It's not canon.
It's like it's fan fiction. So I don't need to feel too sad about Donna.
Now, do you think that they've set this up anyway for a third movie? Like, is that a possibility?
Probably not. I don't know. There's no obvious. I don't think there was any obvious, like, you know, setup for it. But
so if they were to do one, what do you think it'd be? Another, like, maybe like Amanda Seyfried,
yeah,
dealing with her daughter type thing.
Yeah, I think it would have to be, and it would have to have like the other characters in it somehow, like Colin Firth and stuff. Yeah.
I don't put that past Hollywood.
Yeah,
because it's very much a thing. It's very much a thing right now to just keep plopping out, you know, old works because people are so nostalgic. Like, people are craving nostalgia right now.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me.
So, Amy Merrigan, this is the moment we've all been waiting for. How do you feel about Mamma Mia?
Well, I mean, I think I've made it quite clear how I feel about Mamma Mia.
Yes.
The question is, how do you guys feel about Mamma Mia?
I feel changed.
I'm so pleased.
I feel like I'm going to go watch the second one, and I'm probably going to go rewatch the first one or two more times and look at it through this lens that you presented of strong, powerful women and really look into the music side of it. So I'm excited, Amy. You brought out this whole new thing for me.
I'm so excited.
I sort of totally agree. I mean, the whole thing is obviously very fun. But watching it last night, you know, it never really occurred to me all of this stuff that you just said, that, you know, that while on the surface it might seem like a cheesy everybody sings kind of movie, it's actually, you know, the kind of movie that doesn't get made very often, featuring characters that often aren't showcased in this sort of big budget Hollywood movie. So, you know, it's just something that never had occurred to me watching it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it's great to have a podcast where smart people can tell you how to feel about things. Well, this was fun. Amy, you got to come back.
Well, I would love to. This has been delightful.
Before we go, is there anything you want to promote? Do you want to get a job out of this? We have millions of listeners, so this will go far, whatever you say.
Do you have millions?
So many.
Well, you can follow me on Twitter. It's at Amy Merrigan. But that's about it for self-promotion.
I'm not sure if you listened last week, but we're trying to end each episode with a podcast recommendation. Seems like a nice thing to do. I'm putting you on the spot, but do you have a recommendation for these people?
I always, always do. My favorite podcast at the moment it's called The High-Low, and it's by two journalists called Dolly Alderton and Pandora Sykes, and the kind of concept of it is to talk about things that are really high culture and things that are really like low culture at the same time.
Ooh.
Or put them right next to each other. So like, okay, so like a few weeks ago the title was Trump's Baby Balloon and Why Natural Beauty is a Damaging Stereotype. So there's just a lot of stuff thrown in there, like trivial, important, all of it. And it's really good.
Yeah. This sounds very up my alley. So I'm excited.
Have you guys got any good podcast recommendations?
My current favorite, and it's been a favorite of mine for over a year now, is Living the Dream with Rory O'Malley. He was in the original cast of Book of Mormon. He played the king in Hamilton. He was in Dreamgirls. But he has this podcast where he sits down with all these big names, you know, from the theater scene and from the film scene and movie scene, and just really goes in depth of like what it means to be an artist and how people, how people's journeys ended up playing out and how they got to where they are. So it's really inspiring and gives me hope for the creative field. So I highly recommend Living the Dream with Rory O'Malley.
I have subscribed to it as you were talking.
I'm so excited. You're going to love it, Amy.
Andrew, any good ones?
So my recommendation this week is a podcast that I've been listening to quite a bit in the past couple of days. So it's on my mind, and it sort of ties into some of the music-y stuff we've been talking about this episode. And this podcast is called 20,000 Hertz, and it's about the sound design in music that is found in various parts of life. So they did an episode on the music of slot machines and how it's used to draw people in and make people feel happy about themselves. There was this really good two-part episode about that the THX sound at the beginning of movies, that and the story behind it and what it's doing to make you feel all excited to watch a movie. So it's an independent podcast just made by some really smart people. And I've been, the production value is really amazing. And I've been very impressed with everything they're doing and highly, highly recommend to anyone listening to this. So that's what I would recommend this week.
Nice. Bum, 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 na, na.